Okay, it's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Et Shalom, Yitzchak Shalom, who last taught our EFA series back over the summer. Really a master educator, teacher, has been spending many years, as you heard, in California. I'm just holding up now one of the books he has, Between the Lines of the Bible, his series. I don't know, has your book on Amos come out yet?
It's coming out in, I believe, January.
Okay, Koren will be publishing the rabbi's book on Amos. He gives a Daf Yomi Shir podcast teaching all over in the, been many times at Torah Moshe. Before we begin, I just want to mention, to let people know, last week Ruth Shane gave the Parsha Shir. I couldn't be here. We had the parent-teacher night, but I hear it was really wonderful. Unfortunately, Ruth is sitting Shiva. Her brother passed away yesterday. So I know she comes to many, many classes, and many of you know her from all our classes. So I just wanted to let people know we should have happy occasions to have nechama and comfort, and we should have happy occasions to celebrate. Okay, Rabbi, Yaakov and Esav, the Midrashic perspective. Vavakasha.
Okay. Greetings, everybody. How are you doing? It is now about 5:30 where I am. I was told that the shiur goes till 9:30, correct, Rabbi Kelman? Good. Okay.
Yes, so 1 hour. Give or take a minute or two on either side.
Right, but yes. You go till 9:30, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have 5:30, so we'll be here for about 4 hours. Settle in.
Okay, there you go. There you go. Four hours. Okay, we can go. We're having 5 hours on Sunday, so what's 4 hours on Thursday night? Okay.
I don't want to scare anybody. I'm just kidding. It'll just be an hour. I'm actually going to make the shiur about 45 to 50 minutes because I think the shiur hopefully will inspire some questions. I'm going to leave some Q&A time at the end. The topic of the shiur is not the title. The topic of the title of the shiur is Yaakov and Esav, but really the topic of the shiur is a much larger question, which is what is the agenda of Midrash? Both in general, and we're going to talk about specific areas of Midrash. Yaakov and Esav is just a marvelous example of this issue. So without going further on that, we're going to dive right into the text that we have. All the texts that we have in front of you are translated immediately underneath. And there'll be several texts that I'll reference, but I'll reference them both in the original and in English, or just only in English, as we come along. I'm going to start from something that's in this week's parasha, which itself deserves a little bit of attention, even though it's tangential to the topic. I expect you guys to all unmic yourselves and share answers here, because I'd like to make this interactive. When you open up a Sefer Torah, which maybe you do on a regular basis, maybe you don't, what do you see inside? What do you see when you open a Sefer Torah? And so we make it a little, crystallize the question, what do you see that looks different than looking at a Tanakh, a printed Tanakh?
Parshia breaks.
You see Parsha breaks, which in many printed Tanakhs we have also, good. What else do you see that is different than a printed Tanakh? Let's say what's missing in the Sefer Torah?
Nekudot.
No Tamei Mikra. All of those markings that were created in the 6th and up to 9th century or so in Tveria and in Bavel are not in the Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah is written without any punctuation, without any vocalization. Correct. However, on occasion, you will find some strange marks in a Sefer Torah which look like Nikudot. The most famous of these is sort of a backwards parenthesis, which looks to us like an upside down nun, which appears in the Torah in two places right next to each other, which kind of form a parenthesis at the end of the 10th chapter of Bamidbar, and that's why Vayihi Saharon. But there is another phenomenon that takes place in 10 different places in the Torah, which is dots on top of letters.
And Vayishakehu.
And we refer to these as dotted words. Right. I'd like to start with the comment of the Sifri, which is the Midrash Tanaim on Bamidbar and Dvarim. Here in Bamidbar, on Parshat Balotcha. Parshat Balotcha includes the passage about the Pesach Sheni. And the rule of the Pesach Sheni is that anybody who was Tamei, Tameit, or was far away from the Mikdash when Pesach Rishon happened, is allowed to do Pesach Sheni. In describing the distance which makes you far away, the Torah says, Bederech Rechoka, a far distance. So please take a look at the first source. The Midrash points out, Nakud al ha-hei, meaning when in the word Rechoka, there's a dot on the hay. And by the way, open a Sefer Torah, you will see every proper Sefer Torah, there's a hay, there's a dot on top of the hay. Why? Shafilu b'derach krova v'hu tamei lo haya osei mahem et ha-pesach kayotze bo, and then they give other examples. And the idea is that it doesn't really have to be that distant. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah in Psachim says, even if you're right outside of the courtyard of the Mikdash, but you don't come inside, you're still considered a distant, and you get a pass to do it the next month. I'm not concerned with the halachot of Pesach Sheni right now. What I want to point out is, what is the Sifri doing with the dot? The Sifri says there's a dot over the hay. That means I'm supposed to read extra meaning into the word, different than the simple read of the word. It's as if, and this is a Masoretic note, meaning this goes back to at least the 6th century, if not earlier, that we have to have this dot on the hay, and that means that there's some subliminal message or some subtle message in that word that's not obvious that needs to be communicated. And that's a halachic message about how far away you need to be considered a candidate for the Pesach Sheni. Kayotzebo. And then the Midrash gives another example. Yishpot Adonai b'ni u'b'necha. When Sarai is angry at Hagar, when Hagar is asking all uppity, when she gets pregnant, she comes to Avram, she yells at Avram, and she says, God should judge between us. Nakud alav. There's a dot over the yod of b'necha. There's a dot. Shelo amra lo ella al Hagar bilvad. Meaning, she wasn't really angry at Avram. She was only angry about this particular thing of Hagar. The Yesh Omrim al Hametilim Mireva Beino Levena. And maybe it's actually alluding to the curse on people who generate animosity between a husband and a wife. Kayotzebo. Here's another example, also from the life of now Avraham and Sarah, after their names got changed. Vaimre la vayesh Sarah Ishtecha. When the three visitors, after they eat the meal that Avram brings them, say, where is Sarai, your wife? Vemur elav. Nakud alav. The word elav has three of the four letters have dots on them. Shayu yodim echani, because it means they really actually did know where she was, right? But they're asking it pro forma. Kayotzebo, and then there's another example from the story of Lot. I don't want to belabor it, but you get the point. That the way the Midrash is reading the dots is that when there is a word in the Torah, and again, there's only 10 examples of this in the whole Torah, when there's a word in the Torah that our Masorah demands that in the Sefer Torah we put a dot over one or more of the letters of that word, it means we should read the word with an awareness that there's another meaning going on besides, not in place of, but in addition to the basic simple meaning. And then we get to our parashah. Kayotzebo vayishakehu. This is when Esav and Yaakov have their reunion, their long-awaited, and in case of Yaakov, the long-feared reunion. Remember that our parsha starts out, and Tavayishlach starts out, with Yaakov getting out of the clutches of Lavan, coming south, and then sending messengers to Esav to let him know that he is on his way, and he's sending a gift. And then the message comes back that Esav is coming with 400 men. Yaakov assumes that 400 men means an army and that Esav is going to try to kill him. And Yaakov goes into all the preparations he goes into. And then he sends a great gift. And then he has a midnight wrestling match. What that's about is a big machloket rishonim. And then the next day is the actual reunion. And Yaakov comes and he falls at his feet in front of Esav 7 different times. And he sets up his family and he has this whole gift coming, and Esav comes to meet him, and surprise, surprise, Esav does not attack. Esav embraces. Esav and Yaakov fall on each other's necks and they weep. And in the middle of it, you have the word Vayishakehu. Esav falls on Yaakov's shoulder, neck and weep and cry and kisses him. Vayishakehu. However, the word Vayishakehu, every one of those letters, every one of those six letters has a dot on top of it in the Sefer Torah. This Shabbat, take a look, right? If you can see well enough, when they do Hagba, maybe they'll have it open to that section. If not, walk up in the middle, if you can, I don't know, and take a look, and you'll see Vayishakehu. There's dots on those letters. Why? Nakuda lav shalon yishako b'chol libo. So what's the drasha? The drasha is he kissed him, but he didn't really mean it. In other words, it wasn't a real kiss. By the way, who do we know of? And I'll open the mics again. Who do we know of in Chumash that kisses anybody?
Yaakov.
Rachel when he first sees her. Who else? So when Aaron meets Moshe out in the desert. In other words, his close family members, right? Now, the notion is that when somebody kisses somebody, it's a kiss of tremendous feeling. By the way, the kisses that we read of in Chumash are never erotic or passionate. They are always kisses of friendship, of relief, of family closeness. All right? They're not erotic kisses. But they are understood to be wholehearted. And the idea is that there's dots on this one to say Aesop's kiss wasn't so wholehearted. His heart wasn't really in it. However, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, you've heard of him, actually has a different take. And he reads as follows. And I'm going to go off a tangent in a second because it's critical. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Halo biyadua she'esav sone liyakov. We all know that Esav really hates Yaakov. Ela nefchu rachamav biota sha'a uneshako b'chol libo. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai disagrees with the first approach and says, we all know that Esav really hates Yaakov. But what happens? At that moment, he was overwhelmed by compassion, and he actually kissed him wholeheartedly. So in other words, Vayishakehu here, the dots, according to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, are there to indicate that even though we might think that Esav didn't really mean it. He did it because of family. He did it because he was afraid. He didn't really mean it. No, he actually did mean it. Now, the tangent is, if you know, take a look at the text in front of you, in source one, Shimon Bar Yochai says, Halo biyadua. Indeed, we know. Don't we all know that Esav hates Yaakov? There is another version of that text, which is, by the way, probably an errant version. It says, Halacha biyadua she'esav soneh liyaakov. That it is a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. It is, all of the good manuscripts seem to confirm that that's not the right word, that it should be halo. But for some reason, halacha became very popular, and it's quoted in all the secondary literature as if that's what the text says. And the difference, of course, is that there is no such thing as a halacha that somebody hates somebody. Halacha means there's a directive of how to behave, and so some people interpret it as being, you know, it's built in, etc. Maybe it's the case. We're going to see more about this particular relationship, but notice that what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is doing with these dots is saying these dots actually are dots of intensification, that Esav, who we expected would just kiss him pro forma, actually was kissing him wholeheartedly and really meant it. Now, there's an interesting background to this Esav hating Yaakov thing, which is really at the core of the whole beginning of our parsha, and that's what I wanted to elaborate on. And sadly, I mean, I just came back from a visit to Israel. My son is serving near Jenin, and came to visit him. Sadly, this is a parsha which is very real and very impactful today, since October 7th. A very, very real parsha. Real meaning it's always real, but it's real to us right now. Midrash Tehillim, which is the late Midrash, 9th to 10th century, has the following comment. In Perek Chafei, you have Re'ei Oivai Kirabu Sinat Hamas Sineuni. And this is David. And David is saying, look, my enemies are so many, and they hate me with a hatred of violence. And the Midrash, that's the Pasuk. Watch what the Midrash says. Im Esav sone liyakov. If Esav hates Yaakov, lefi shenatal mimenu ta b'chora, because after all, Yaakov exploited Esav's hunger and got the primogenitor from him. V'hadin imo, which means Esav has every right to hate Yaakov because Yaakov took something from him. Aval barbarim v'antiim sherit amim me'asiti lahem. But David is saying, what did I do? We now borrow a very anachronistic term, which is the Berbers. But what are these guys? What did I do to them that they should hate me? In other words, he's calling their hatred for him, sinat chinam, right? As you see in the text, he's calling it sinat chinam. They hate me for nothing, as opposed to Esav, whose hatred for Yaakov is understandable. Yaakov took something from him, which means we're actually putting a softer touch on Esav's hatred for Yaakov. Now, we have to step aside for a second, and we're going to take a few minutes, but I'm actually going to go off to share for a bit. When we say that Esav hates Yaakov, where did we get that information from, that Esav hates Yaakov? Why would we think that Esav hates Yaakov? Not why would Esav have a reason to hate Yaakov, but why would we think that Esav actually hates Yaakov? Based on what?
Based on his desire to kill him.
When does he express a desire to kill him?
When Rivka overhears that he intends to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Good. Which means Esav has a hot temper. Well, as soon as he finds out that Yaakov tricked and got the blach, somebody has to turn off the feedback problem. That Yaakov was able to get the bracha away, or steal the bracha, deceive his father, get the bracha. Esav was enraged. And Esav, as we know, is a man of, shall we say, a hot temper, and has an issue with delayed gratification. He has to have what he wants now, right now. Doesn't make him a bad guy, just makes him an immature guy, maybe. And he says, I'm going to kill Yaakov. Right? Now, at some point between when he said that and when Yaakov returned, he obviously calmed down because he embraced him. Question is, when did he calm down? We have no reason to think he didn't calm down pretty immediately afterwards. Esav was a man of explosive emotions, and that's it. So
his mother said he'll come down after Yamim Achadim.
Say it again?
His mother tells him, go to my brother Levan, Yeshabtaimo Yamim Achadim, Ad Sheyashuv Chamatachicha.
Okay, so you tell me, how long is Yamim Achadim?
Well, Yamim Achadim ended up being 22 years, as we know in Russia.
Or maybe much longer. But in the meantime, how long is Yamim, what is that anticipation of Yamim Achadim?
I don't know. Was Rivka not being truthful?
Yamim Achadim sounds like it means a few months, maybe a few years at most. Certainly not decades, right? And by the way, what's Rivka say she's going to do when Esav calms down? Right? She'll send a message to Yaakov and tell Yaakov it's time to come back. She never sent that message, right? Which means one of several things. It means either Esav never calmed down, but we see that that's not the case in our parsha. Or it could mean that Esav calmed down, but by that time Rivka had passed away, so she couldn't send the message. That's possible. Or it could be that Rivka wanted Yaakov to stay there for other reasons, which is part of a much larger parsha. But it seems that Rivka really did direct Yaakov to go there and to be there for quite a while. I'll have to ask someone to mute because there's a lot of ambient noise. If you remember, Yaakov left only because Hashem told him to leave, because Lavan suddenly turned sour on him, and because Bnei Lavan were complaining, not because he got a message from Rivka, right? So the question is what that's all about. But we don't know that Esav really has this kind of hatred for Yaakov. However, and this is where I want to move to, and this is the larger part of the shiur, what is the agenda of Midrash? And I mean that in the most general sense. What is the agenda of Midrash Agadah? The Midrash Agadah, just very quick, what is Midrash? I mean, let's make sure we're all on the same page. We're on the same screen, on the same page. What is Midrash? When we say Midrash, what do we mean?
Rabbinic exposition.
Rabbinic what?
Exposition.
Very good. That's a very good way to put it. Rabbinic exposition, in which we are finding or getting more information from the text than is readily there. In other words, we're mining the text for more information. That information may be implicit in the text, and it may be kind of read into the text. Now, we have two kinds of midrash. We have midrash halakha, in which we're trying to infer proper practices from a legal text. And then we have the much broader area that we call midrash agadah, which is when you say midrash to somebody on the street, that's what they think you mean, which is midrashim that are typically about narratives or about poetry in Tanakh, and which then give us stories and embellishments and expansions and background, etc., on that story. Now, what's the agenda of Midrash Haggadah? So the answer is there's not one answer. But there is one, among several, there is one agenda which the Midrash Agadah is driven by in many, many cases. And that is to make Tanakh alive. In other words, the characters in Tanakh, the events in Tanakh, which happened, in the case of Midrash, 1,000 to 2,000 years earlier, suddenly become contemporary events. As an example, and we'll stay with, I'll give an example from Haman, because Haman's a great example of this. The Midrash Esther describes Haman and puts in Haman's mouth anti-Semitic tropes. Anti-Semitic is an anachronism, but anti-Jewish tropes, which were heard of in the 3rd century and 4th century in Rome. Never heard of in Persia, heard in Rome. In one of the Midrashim, Haman complains that the Jews aren't observing the local holidays, including Saturnalia and Calenda, which are Roman pagan holidays. Why would Haman, in Persia of 5th century BCE, care about the Jews not keeping Roman pagan holidays? The answer is, of course he doesn't care about that. But what the Midrash is doing is it's taking the canards of the current anti-Semites and putting it into Haman's mouth. By the way, it shouldn't surprise you. You know what the most popular Haman costume was in Germany in the 1930s? Was a mustache. It shouldn't be strange. And the most popular for anybody who was in Israel at the time, most popular Haman costume in the early 90s was a Saddam Hussein mask. Because Haman then becomes whoever the current enemy is. And that's something that happens in Midrash a lot. I'll give you one other example. We go back to our text. Who is Lavan? So Lavan in the text, if you look at it carefully in last week's parasha, Lavan is an okay guy. Lavan has a good relationship with Yaakov. Lavan actually comes out looking like he's taken the moral high road relative to Yaakov in the issue of the wives. Look carefully at that parasha. Lavan only goes sour on Yaakov when Bnei Lavan start complaining, and of course, blood is thicker than water. Take a look very carefully at Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, and Pasuk Bet, and you'll see that that's when Lavan's relationship with Yaakov sours, is when he has his own sons that are evidently born after Yaakov entered the household, and they start complaining about Yaakov taking the family wealth. And then Lavan becomes negative, and that's when Yaakov leaves. However, who does Lavan become in the Midrash? Lavan becomes a scourge from minute one. And Lavan becomes not just a kind of obnoxious father-in-law, but rather an enemy who intends to kill his own family. How do we start the Haggadah? Lavan bikesh lakor takol. Lavan wanted to kill everybody. As a matter of fact, there's a little piece here that a lot of people make the claim, and I think there's something to it. I mean, can't swear to it, is that when we describe at the beginning of the Haggadah, Say Umad, Ma Bikesh Lavan Ha'arami, Lasot Yaakov Avinu, that a lot of people, Lavan Ha'arami, they read that as Lavan Ha'Romai. And that the idea is that Lavan is a very quiet reference to the current Romans, who are, at the time of the Haggadah's composition, who are looming over them, and you can't say that out loud because you get killed, and so we call him Lavan Ha'arami. But wink, wink, we all know who we're talking about. This is an important point of Midrash. And the same thing happens to Esav. Esav in the Midrash, which is what we're focusing on here, is painted as somebody with undying enmity towards Yaakov. In other words, towards Yaakov's children, who will do anything he can to kill them. And therefore, Shimba Yochai turns around and says, why are there dots on Vishakehu? Because surprise, surprise, in this case, he actually was filled with compassion for his brother and kissed him wholeheartedly. But now take a look at how far the Midrash will go on this Esav image that it develops. Amar Yehuda bar Bilai, source 3. Rebbe Aya Doresh, the following. And Rebbe here is probably Rebbe Akiva. Because Rebbe Yehuda bar Bilai, he's quoting Rebbe, that's Rebbe Akiva. Aya Doresh, Hakol Kol Yaakov. You familiar with the Pasuk? Hakol Kol Yaakov, Adem Yedei Esav. Hakol kol Yaakov, what's that? Matzviach b'masha asulo hayadayim yedei Esav. That the way we read the Pasuk simply is, Hakol kol Yaakov, Yitzchak is confused. This sounds like one of my sons, but it feels like the other one of my sons. I'm confused as to who it is. The famous drashot on this phrase, Hakol kol Yaakov hayadayim yedei Esav. This midrash is, Yaakov's voice is not the voice of Yaakov learning or Yaakov praying. It's the voice of Yaakov screaming. Why is he screaming? Because of Mashasulo David Esav, because of what the hands of Esav have done to him. And Rabbi Yochanan, a couple of generations later, gives another example of this. Call Adrianus. Adrianus is Hadrian. And Hadrian was the one who instituted the very strong persecutions in the fourth decade of the second century, right after Bar Kokhba. Adrianus Shachi Katsamot, Adrianus, whose bones should burn. Horeg beBeitar 80 elef ribo bnei adam. The reports of the massacre at Beitar, which according to the Mishnah happened on Tisha B'Av of 135, has 800,000 people being killed in one fell swoop. In other words, he is the hands of Esav, and this is the voice of Yaakov screaming because they're being murdered. This is how the Midrash is developing it. Now, moving on, we see the Midrashic development of Esav now taking on the persona of somebody very real in their times. In the Pasuk that Bilam says, which is the great blessing, now Bilam wants to curse us, but then ends up blessing us. And in the bracha that he gives us at the end, which is the sort of apocalyptic, eschatological blessing of what's going to happen in the end of days, Erenu velo ata ashurenu velo karov. You see him the translation. Darach kochav mi Yaakov becomes shevet mi Israel. So a star will shoot forth from Yaakov, and a scepter will stand up in Israel. Umachatz pate moav akarkar gomenei sheit. Essentially, a star is going to shoot forth from Yaakov and destroy all of Israel's enemies, and that includes Edom. Right? And now, if you take a look at this very famous Midrash, it's famous not so much for the Midrash itself, but for what we do with it, and the way it's kind of been popularized. Rav Yochanan. So Rav Yochanan, again, tells us, Kad ha-vechazi Rav Akiva leven Kospa. There was a fellow named Shimon bar Kospa who started a very popular rebellion in about the year 130, 132. And it was rebellion against the Romans when the Romans had announced plans to flatten Har HaBayit and build a pagan temple there. When Rabbi Akiva saw Bar Kospa, his name was Shimon Bar Kospa, Have Amar Darach Kochav Mi Yaakov. He would recite that pasuk and point to him. Darach Kochav Mi Yaakov Ze Melech HaMashiach. He said that pasuk in Bilam's bracha is an allusion to the star shooting forth, which will be the Mashiach. What's going to make him Mashiach? The fact that he is going to attack and eradicate Edom. Look back at the Psukim. And you'll notice from the rest of this Midrash, Yocha Mentorta Akiva Yalu Asavim Bukhayacha Badaim Ben David Enoba. This is one of many oppositions to Rabbi Akiva in his identification of Ben Bar Kokhba as the Mashiach, where he says, you'll have grass growing from your cheeks, meaning you'll be dead a long time and Mashiach won't yet have come. In other words, this guy is not the guy. But the point is that Rabbi Akiva, at least, identified midrashically Bar Kokhba as the star that's going to, he called him Bar Kokhba because he's the star that's going to shoot forth because he's attacking Edom. Now, what does Edom have to do with anything here? The answer is Edom, which is the nation of Esav. Esav hu Edom, we read that twice in our parsha, once in Vayetze and Toldot, and then twice in our parsha, Esav hu Edom. Edom becomes identified midrashically with Rome. Now let's step back from that a second and see why that's difficult in a real world sense. Who is Edom? The answer is Edom are the descendants of Esav. Who is Esav? Esav is Yaakov's brother. That makes him a pure Semite. Now, who are the Romans? We talk about the Romans. So the Romans are broadly understood to be descendants of Yefet, right? And Chazal all over the place talk about how Roman and Greek culture have a place in the Beit Midrash, Yaf Yutoshel Yefet, Mishkon Bo Alei Shem, riffing off of the Pasuk in the ninth chapter of Bereshit. And yet, Edom, which is a Semitic nation, suddenly becomes transformed into Rome. How do I see that? Because the guy who's going to take the battle to Rome is considered to be the guy who's taking the battle to Edom. And there's more to that. In Yeshayahu Lamed Daled, you see this passage in front of you. And in the second pasuk in this passage, Vayardu Re'emim Imam, right, that the Re'emim literally means wild oxen. Watch what happens. Amar Meir Vayardu Romi'im Imam. Now this opens up a parsha that I'm just going to allude to now because it's way too deep and too big, which is the lexicography of Rabbi Meir. Reb Meir is often quoted in Chazal as in his version of the text, there was a slight emendation. Quote, not or with an aleph instead of an ayin, etc. And here, in Reb Meir's version of Sefer Yeshayahu, look again at the pasuk. Pasuk Zayin. V'yardu re'emim, and re'emim is wild oxen. In Reb Meir's text of Yeshayahu, what he wrote was not re'emim, but romim. The Romans, and suddenly the Romans suddenly come alive in Sefer Yeshayahu. You have the same thing happen elsewhere in Yeshayahu. By the way, in Sefer Yeshayahu, from chapter 13 till about chapter 24, it says Masot Neged Hamim. He has oracles against the different nations. And in Perek Chaf Aleph in the middle, he has Masad Duma. Who's Duma? We don't know. Right? The oracle against Duma. Look at what we have again in Reb Meir, and now it's written in Reb Meir's version of Sefer Yeshayahu, Masa Romi. In other words, what Reb Meir was willing to do was to see Rome, which of course Rome is ancient, goes back to the 8th century BCE, but Rome only comes onto our stage in world history in the second century BCE, and yet Reb Meir sees Rome already written in to Nevuot going back to the 8th century. In other words, this is again the project of Midrash, to bring the texts of Tanakh and make them very real and actual in our lives. Our lives meaning the lives of Eretz Yisrael in the 4th century, or in the case of Meir in the 2nd century. I'll give you another example of this, and then we're going to start bringing all of these strings together. Sefer Amos, and as Rabbi Cohen mentioned, I have a particular affinity for Amos, besides really liking chocolate chip cookies. And the beginning of Sefer Amos is made up of oracles against many nations, basically all the nations that surround Israel, including Yehuda. There's an oracle about the punishment they're going to get, and it follows the same pattern of Al Shlosha Pishei, the nation, V'al Ra'al Ashivenu. I'm going to punish them for the three terrible things they did, and the fourth was over the top. And then we hear about what seemingly is the fourth thing that they did, which is so terrible. And when he gets to Edom, which again is Esav, Kormar Adonai El Shloshah Pishei Edom V'al Arba'a Lo Ashivenu. And what is it that Edom did that was so terrible? By the way, the crimes that are mentioned there, sadly, are things that we can very much relate to in the aftermath of October 7th. If you take a look right away at the beginning in Pasuk Dalad, Pasuk Gimel, about what Syria did, Aram did. But here, what did Edom do? Al rodfo v'cherev achiv v'shichet rachamav. For chasing his brother with the sword and destroying his own compassion, v'yitrof la'ad apo v'evrato shemara netzach. He kept his anger alive forever and held on to his enmity forever. In other words, what is it that's so bad about Edom? Edom chased his own brother with a sword and kept himself from having any compassion to the brother. The opposite of what Shem Bayechai says happened with Esav in this meeting. And now in Mishnat Reb Eliezer, which is a late Midrash, we have the following description of Esav. Af Esav kachasa. Now, by the way, again, Edom, Esav. By the way, again, another thing that happens in the Midrash as part of the whole picture is a personification, meaning a nation acts, it becomes personified in the eponymous founder of the nation, right? So that we have this, by the way, in our own family, when we talk about Yehuda's actions, the man Yehuda, as reflected in the tribe of Yehuda hundreds of years later, and vice versa. So the same thing happens here. Af Esav kachasa. This is what Esav did. Natal tazayan, he took his sword. Yatzali cried Yaakov Avinu. He came out to kill Yaakov. Now, this is the Midrash, and this is what happened when Yaakov stole the bracha. Imo lefit sidkuta amra yamim achadim. So Rivka said, you go and stay just a few days, he'll calm down. Halach v'yashav esrim shana v'lo shachah chamato. So this Midrash is picking up on the thing that I discussed earlier. Yaakov went and he waited 20 years and Esav never calmed down. 20, 22, whatever, never calmed down. To teach you that Esav's blood, Esav's livelihood, Esav's whole orientation was murderous. And therefore, if he got in his head he's going to kill Yaakov, that just doesn't go away. Shenemar, and how do we know that Esav is bloodthirsty and killing is part of who he is? And again, we're personifying the nation and we're nationalizing the person. Take a look. Shenemar Korma Adonai al Shlosha Pishei Adom al Rodfo Becherav Achiv. They quotes the Pasuk in Amos and says, what was the great sin of Edom? The fact that Edom chased their brother with the sword and did not allow themselves to have any compassion. Now, Edom here is approximately 1,000 years after Esav lived, 800 years after Esav lived. Doesn't matter. In the Midrash, none of that matters. In the Midrash, we have a time warp in which the man Esav meeting with Yaakov somewhere in, we'll call it the 16th century BCE, and the nation of Edom, Esav's descendants, and their interaction with Am Yisrael in, we'll call it, the 8th century BCE, 800 years later, it's all one thing. That's how Midrash operates. All right, so what happened? Going back, we see that Esav himself, in his own behavior, did not calm down from his anger against Yaakov. And we see that in the nation of Edom. Right, that Edom chased their brother. Who's that? Zeh Yaakov. V'shichet rachamav. And he hurt his own compassion. What does it mean? Shigaram l'rivka sh'ne'esfa. Now, this is, again, one of the agendas of Midrash, a different agenda, but important to note, is that Midrash also tries to fill in blanks. You'll notice in the story of the Avot, do we hear about Avram's passing? We do. Do we hear about Sarah's passing? Famously, we do. Do we hear about Yitzchak's passing? We do in this week's parasha. Do we hear about Yaakov's passing? Ooh, there's a big parasha in Vayechi about that. Do we hear about Rachel passing away? We do in our parasha, the birth of Binyamin. How about Rivka? Do we hear about Rivka passing away?
No.
Never hear about it. Do we hear about Leah?
No Rivka and no Leah.
Right. Because the truth is that hearing about someone passing away is unusual. We ask, how come Rivka and Leah aren't mentioned? The real question is, why is Sarah mentioned? Why is Rachel mentioned? The answer is, Sarah is mentioned because of the purchase of Machpelah, and Rachel is mentioned because of the tragedy of her death on the road and the birth of Binyamin. All right? And the mention of Avraham and Yishmael, and by the way, we don't hear about Esav either, but Avraham and Yishmael, and Yitzchak and Yaakov is really to show that the bracha of many children, etc., was fulfilled and around their deathbed, right? So now Rivka dies and we never hear about it. So why did she die? So that's room for lots of midrashic speculation. Here the notion is that Rivka died of a heartbreak because her two sons were at each other, meaning Esav was unrelenting in his hatred for Yaakov and his readiness to kill him. So therefore, Garam Rivka Shinesfa Velo Rat Yaakov, she never again saw her favorite son Yaakov. The Fichach Loni's Kiramita Taba Torah, and now the Midrash, taking the opposite assumption that we would hear about every death, says we don't mention her death, Shaloya Yaakov Sham, Tsivtavo Tsiwa Balaila. Famous Midrashic idea that Rivka directed, since Yaakov's not here, I want you to bury me at night quietly. I don't want Esav to know I'm dead. I don't want him to participate at all. I'll get some cousins or some servants to bury me because Yaakov's not here. And it all happened because Esav would not give up on his hatred for Yaakov and is ready to kill him. Right? Vaytrof apo. Now, here we go. In the Pasuk in Amos, it says he held on to it. He hurt his compassion forever and he held on to his anger. What's that? Zeh Amalek. How did Amalek get into this picture? The answer is, who's Amalek? The guy Amalek. The guy Amalek is the grandson of Esav. So suddenly now, all of this hatred and all of this bloodthirsty attitude that Esav has towards Yaakov becomes manifested in Amalek against Israel. And that's the La'ad Apo, that he held on to his anger forever, meaning his generations continued with his hatred and anger just because he's angry. And it goes all the way to the Persian era. Right? This is now referring to the first Mikdash, when we were exiled from Yerushalayim. Bnei Esav stood on the road, and anybody who wanted to run away from the row of exiles, Bnei Esav would come and kill them. In other words, Bnei Esav were described as the willing henchmen of the Babylonians. Does that sound familiar? As having the militarily successful army come in and hurt Am Yisrael, and then the locals become their very willing henchmen to help out. That's what World War II was about. Parenthetically, what is the psalm that describes the destruction of Yerushalayim? It doesn't really describe this. It describes the wailing after the destruction.
Shir Malos.
Kuflam Zayin.
All of us are returning.
Oh.
Al Naharat Bavel. Kuflam Zayin. And in Al Naharat Bavel, there's a line that's very hard to decipher. It says, Zechor Adonai Livnei Adom et Yom Yerushalayim. Hashem, remember, meaning take vengeance on Bnei Adom, that on the day of the destruction of Yerushalayim, they came in and said, strip her naked. And the sense here is that Bnei Adom, again, Esav, when the Babylonians were coming and conquering, that they stood in and they said, you didn't do enough, destroy Yerushalayim even more. That they were pushing it even further. Again, the willing henchmen of the invading army. Right? And in this story, they would, if they couldn't kill the Jews, they'd hand them over to Nebuchadnezzar, etc. Now notice, and we don't have to go on the details, but notice how the Midrash is picking up on the Pasuk in Amos and seeing it as describing an endless hatred that Esav has for Yaakov, grounded in Yaakov stealing the bracha from him. At that point, Esav loses it, but he never loses his losing it. He never loses his anger and his willingness to kill. And again, transmuted to his children and to his descendants and through his nation. And who is his nation? His nation is Edom. But again, what happens to his nation? It transmogrifies from Edom to Rome. Now, parenthetically, in the Midrashic literature, Rome becomes the manifestation of Esav and of Amalek, and it doesn't stop there. In around the 5th century or so, that switches from Rome to the Vatican. And in later Midrashic literature, the church is seen as the embodiment of Esav and of Amalek. And taking the stories that we have in, and we're going to see an example of that in a minute, taking the stories that we have in our parasha about the man Esav, who in simple pshat loves his brother, embraces his brother, kisses his brother, says, I don't need your gifts, I'm just happy to see you. But in the Midrash is filled with hatred and is filled with the desire to kill him. There's even one Midrash that Vayishakehu really should be read as Vayinashkehu. He wanted to bite Yaakov on the neck, but Yaakov's neck turned into marble, famous Midrash. Of that. And so again, the Midrash is developing that this relationship, which starts with these two brothers, doesn't ever end. And it continues till this day. But what's also interesting is the identity of Esav is fungible. The identity of Esav is malleable. It goes from the man Esav to his descendants of Edom, who then somehow become Rome when Edom is off the map, who suddenly then becomes the church when the church becomes, when the Roman Empire becomes the Holy Roman Empire. And then a couple hundred years later, the Midrash starts identifying the church as that. And in homiletic literature ever since, the Crusaders, and then the Inquisition, and then Khmelnytsky, and then the pogroms, and I'm skipping a lot, and then of course in the Shoah, to the point where Rabbi Soloveitchik famously in Kol Dodi Dofeik identified the Nazis as Amalek. I'm taking a very large parsha and doing it very quickly. But that's what happens in the Midrashic literature with Esav. It's critical that when we're reading Tanakh, and it's something that I face as a high school rabbi every day, and every year we encounter this, when studying Tanakh, we have to be able to distinguish between what the text of Tanakh is telling us and what the Midrashic development around it has done. I try to get the students to read the characters of Tanakh, whether it's Esav or Abraham or Lavan or Yaakov, to read them as they are in the Tanakh. And they are very surprised to find that there are many Rishonim who read them that way too. Then we go to the Midrashim that they're familiar with, and we see what is the Midrash's agenda in trying to get these characters to be, shall we say, more caricature-like in their greatness or in their evil. So I want to show you this Ramban. This Ramban is something that everybody should be familiar with. One of the most mysterious stories, maybe the most mysterious story in all of Chumash, not in all of Tanakh, maybe along with Moshe at the Lodge, is the story of Yaakov and his midnight wrestling match, which is in the middle of this week, near the beginning of this week's parashah. What is Yaakov's wrestling match? Well, the answer is just about every Rishon has a different take on it. Who is this Malach? What's he trying to do? Why is Yaakov lamed? Why is the laming happen right there on his body? You name it. Everybody's got a different take. The Ramban here, I just summarized what he said at the bottom. The Ramban, in his commentary on the Torah, takes a different take than the one we're accustomed to, and a different take than Rishonim before him had suggested. He said that the wrestling match between Yaakov and this Malach that takes place in the middle of the night and ends with dawn, and that's important, is a glimpse to the future. And it's alluding to the fact, it's hinting to the fact that in the future, Esav's descendants will wrestle with Yaakov's descendants and will try to utterly wipe us out, as symbolized by his reaching over right near the reproductive organs and grabbing him, trying to kill his children. That's the way the Ramban says it. And at the end of that process, Yaakov will emerge not unscathed. He will emerge wounded, limping, but still alive as the sun rises, and the sun rising, of course, being Gula, being redemption. That's the way the Ramban reads it. But how does the Ramban then account? Because other Rishonim suggest that this is related to Esav the man, Esav the brother. This is Esav the future. This is Esav, the nation that's going to attack Yaakov. And then he immediately associates it with the Midrash in Bereshit Rabbah with the Romans. And he said what the Romans did during the Hadrianic persecutions, we talked about that, towards the middle of the second century, that is an example of this wrestling match taking place and the attempt to kill us. And suddenly what Esav is doing to us, and what Esav is pictured as doing to us in this wrestling match, now becomes what the Romans are doing to us in that way. And there's a story that that in Midrash Rabbah, which is a great way to cap this off, because then I'm going to bring it together and then open it up for questions, is the Midrash tells us that Rabbeinu, in this particular case, Rabbeinu is probably Rabbi Yochanan, Karhave Salik L'Malchuta, whenever he had to go to the Malchut, which may mean Caesarea and it may mean Rome. We don't really have records of Rabbi Yochanan going to Rome, but the idea is we lived under Rome, which means that the Jews had to go from time to time to some government center and plead their case and ask for a special dispensation, ask for a break, etc. And their representative would be, in this case, Rabbi Yochanan. Having mistakel ba'ada parshata. First, he would read Parshat Vayishlach, meaning the playbook for dealing with the Romans is Parshat Vayishlach. What do? I split the camp in two, and I pray to Hashem, and I send a big gift. All the things that Yaakov does, because I'm Yaakov, and they're Esav. Now, this, of course, is very much part and parcel of what I described about the Ramban, as seeing the book of Bereishit as a blueprint for the future. And Esav then becomes the Esav of the future, and then that nation, and then Rome, and Yaakov becomes Am Yisrael, etc. So he says, therefore, when Rabbi Yochanan would go to plead the case to the Romans, he would first study Parshat Vayishlach as the playbook. V'lohave nasiv arma aime. He would not take any Romans with him in his entourage, right? Because Vayivater Yaakov levado. In this story, Yaakov's all alone. Chadzman lo istakil. One time he went and he forgot to look in Parshat Vayishlach. V'nasav imei armain. And he took some Romans with him as an escort. By the time he got to Akko, he lost everything. In other words, the idea is that reading Parshat Vayishlach is what you need to do to prepare for meeting with the Romans. Why? And the Romans, or the church, or the government, or whoever it might be, because what Esav is in the Parsha is really emblematic and signifying what the future nations that oppress us and have enmity towards us are like. And if we want to be successful, we should read the story of someone who was successful in his interaction with Esav, which is Yaakov. Now, again, if we hadn't gone through this whole road of 45 minutes together, and if you start by reading Parshat Vayishlach, in which a simple read of Vayishlach has Yaakov being overly worried over essentially nothing, and Esav coming with an entourage of honor and love and reunion, and it's beautiful. But if you read it through the lens of the Midrash, Esav is somebody who is bearing a terrible grudge. It's a grudge that gets transmitted to his children, to his tribes, and then to other people who take on the same attitude towards Yaakov and his children, which, of course, is the oldest disease in the world. We call it anti-Semitism. And therefore, if somebody wants to know, this Midrash is saying, what's a successful way to negotiate these waters? Is read Parshat Vayishlach, where Yaakov was successful in getting out. What we've done over the course of the past 50 minutes almost is we've looked at the midrashic development of the interaction between Yaakov and Esav. Parenthetically, we've got to note, what we did was the tip of the iceberg. There's way, way more midrashic literature on this relationship and on the personalities of Yaakov and Esav and how Esav becomes developed into Edom and then into Rome, etc. Much more about that. But these are like just a sampling of it so we can get a sense of how the Chachamim living in the second and third and fourth centuries in Eretz Israel under Roman rule, how they read our story and how they read our story as being directed towards their reality and speaking towards the relationship with the modern day Esav, which for them was the Romans, and then later on took on the personality of other enemies that they had. So hopefully, over the course of the Shiur, we've had a chance to explore the Midrash, see something about the general Midrashic temperament and agenda of bringing characters in Tanakh alive by having them then be represented by or emblematic of people that we encounter today, and perhaps the perennial character of Esav, the perennial character of Amalek, the perennial Haman against the perennial Yaakov and his children. To whatever extent this helps maybe put the current state of Am Yisrael and the current state of Medinat Yisrael into a little bit of a framework within the Midrash, and maybe that gives us a little bit of a sense of anchoredness, Tezos Chari, but hopefully you enjoyed this travel through the Midrash. If anybody has questions, please go ahead.
Yes, I see the Nakba as an allusion to Yaakov.
Say it again?
I see the so-called Nakba.
Yeah.
Allusion to the defeat by Yaakov of Esav.
Interesting. Okay. By the way, if people put stuff in the chat, I don't open the chat when I'm speaking. So if you put something in there, ask it now. I'm going to take off.
I just want to know whether I understood the Edom as being Rome and Christianity and so on. But now what we're dealing with, I thought it was Ishmael that was really more connected with the Arab world, with the East.
Right. So the whole issue, and you raise a good question, the whole issue of identification of current political, current religious cultural
right.
groups with things in Tanakh are midrashically somewhat slippery. The reason I say that is because, as you see, we are willing very comfortably in homiletic literature to identify Amalek as pretty much anybody who was out to kill us, no matter what religion they are and what cultural and racial background they are. That's Amalek. That's first of all. Second of all, the identification of Ishmael, just a moment on this, with the Arabs is a little bit problematic. We do not find Ishmael identified with the Arabs in Chazal. The first time it shows up, it seems to be in the very early Rishonim. And it has been suggested, I'm not sure that this is completely proven, but it's been suggested that that identification was the result of the Arabs themselves deciding they needed a little bit of yichus, and so they identified themselves as being the children of Ishmael. We don't have any reason to think that Ishmael is really the father of the Arabs, because in the Gemara, we have a whole other word for Arabs, Tanya, and the few times Ishmael is mentioned in the Gemara, as not one of us, I'll get to that in a second, is Ishmael the character, the Ben Avraham, not a Ishmaeli. The Ishmael, on the other hand, interestingly enough, is a very popular Jewish name. There are Kohanim Dolim with the name of Ishmael. There are great Hamim, Ishmael is Rabbi Kiva, right? And Ishmael is a popular name really till the 15th century, believe it or not, but it falls out of major usage in around the 9th century. And there's a good reason for that. Because if you have a name that is a popular name and then your enemy or people who are oppressing you adopt it, suddenly it's not so popular for you anymore. And there's lots of examples of that phenomenon. I'll just give you one more, is that the theophoric ending of names, Baal, was very popular early on in our history. So Shaul named one of his kids Eshbaal, right? And Yonatan had a son, Meriv Baal. But by the time Sefer Shmuel gets put together, Baal is something that's verboten. Take a look at Hoshea Bet, you'll see what I mean. And as a result of that, we no longer use the word Baal, so it's called Ishboshet, and Mephibosheth, and Yerubeshet. All right, we're suddenly embarrassed by it. By the time you get to Divrei Hayamim, Baal is an old story, we don't care about it anymore, it's long gone. So then, in Divrei Hayamim, those names are restored. And this is a common thing, is that phrases and words that we associate with an enemy, before that was the case, we were comfortable using them. David refers to a place as Baal Pratsim. He's not bothered by that, because Baal just doesn't have a bad meaning. In the same way, Ishmael is a popular name for Jews to give their kids until the time that suddenly Ishmael represents a whole ugly culture that's trying to hurt us, and then it falls out of use. When's the last time you wrote a bris where it said, V'yikar Ishmael v'Yisrael, Ishmael? If anybody, by the way, is at a bris where they call the kid Esav, please record it. I'd love to hear it. But okay. In any case, I'm going to wish you all a. Does anybody have any one last question? I think there's time.
I mean, if I may, there were just a couple of questions in the chat box that weren't addressed. If you know, if and I don't think it does exist in the Lir Midrash, but when the Midrash of Lavan Bikesh Lakor Takol, does it appear before the Haggadah anywhere?
No, but the Haggadah is very early.
Okay, because I don't know. I don't know what the source of that Midrash is. Like, it's not. Like,
right. So it does appear in the Sifri. The question is, what came first? The Sifri on Dvarim, and that's Ari Oved Avi.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe it's there. But it is early, but the Haggadah is also very early. I mean, parts of the Haggadah are early.
And also knowing when Mishnat Rabbi Eliezer was written.
Yeah, I think it's 8th century or something. It's a late Midrash.
Okay. I
believe so, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
We have a wonderful Shabbat. And
you mentioned, excuse me for interrupting you. You mentioned somebody, if anybody's named Esav. So I was watching the Israeli news and they introduced somebody named Zimri.
Okay, that's not unusual. You have also Nimrod, you have also the character. But Esav would be a particularly weird thing. All right. Anyway, please, everybody register for the Hanukkah program.
That's my job.
And I will leave you to Rabbi Kelman. And thank you for inviting me on, and I hope that you guys have a decent
and thank you. By the way, I forgot to mention, I know we mentioned Tisha B'Av. Rabbi Echelon made 3 weddings this year, so we want to wish him a triple mazel tov.
Oh, 2.
Oh, no, but it was 3. There was 3 within a year, no? It's just the year's
no,
over. 02. Okay, I apologize.
That's all right. Two was
pretty good. Your son should be well, who's protecting us as part of Sahal, and right. We should all be well. And tomorrow morning, of course, my regular class on the Seder at 9:15, and then on Sunday, 10 speakers beginning at 9:15, half an hour each. I told the speakers to speak 29 minutes, and so we could have a one-minute break. And then there's a 15-minute break, and I said you can have latkes and sufganiyot. As I mentioned earlier, for those who weren't here, so somebody thought it was a live program. They were giving us latkes. As I said, okay, forget my jokes. That is really, I think it's a wonderful program. You can make it, for 5 hours, that's a lot, but come for what you can and let people know about it. I just put the registration link there. My uncle, David Eisenpoint, my uncle, my father, all the siblings called him Adolf, who was the founder of Prospect Park, school in New York. My uncle, Abraham Kelman, but he's known as Adolf. But he was born in 1921, so it's a different world of Ramala. But all so the same thing. Names are strange. But Rabbi Yishmael is such a great person. But you're right, we haven't had a Yishmael for I don't know how long. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov, we should hear good things. David, are we playing? Are we playing tennis? What are we doing this morning? Golf.
I'm playing tennis after Vatikan.
After Vatikan, playing tennis. Okay, enjoy. And okay, singles or doubles?
Today it's singles.
Singles. Okay, very good. Okay, listen, comes from Israel. Get a big yesher koach. Okay, Laila to everybody. We hope to see you soon and everybody be well. And okay, thank you. Bye bye.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Yes.